From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, how the subprime mortgage crisis is impacting Europe. Dicing with death on the roads of Afghanistan. Digging up military history in Bulgaria. And a letter from Nepal. The fallout from the subprime mortgage crisis in the US is now impacting Europe. Financial markets have been in turmoil this week as some of the systemic problems started to surface. And the London markets were also shaken by news that some traders had apparently been starting rumours that another big mortgage lender was in trouble. But it isn't just the stock traders and major investors who are having problems. Many thousands of people who took out big mortgages are finding it difficult to keep up their payments. NPR's Rob Gifford reports.
This is my living room. We went for a 70s feel. As you might have noticed, it's bright orange and we have got original 70s G-Plan furniture, which we're very proud about, but which we found really cheaply.
29-year-old Jessica Shepherd gives a guided tour of her small terraced house in the city of Leicester. She and her boyfriend bought the house 2 years ago on a 35-year mortgage, fixed rate for the first 2 years. Their problem, and the problem of many first-time buyers in Britain, was that they had no deposit. No problem, said Northern Rock, the bank that has since been taken over by the British government. We'll lend you the full 100% plus another 25% of its value so that you can decorate it and pay the legal fees.
It was always going to happen, really, wasn't it? I mean, banks have been lending people money, so much money, so much more than they can afford. It was probably stupid. I wouldn't have given us a mortgage. 125%, I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have given 125% mortgages out. Where's the extra 25% come from? It doesn't come from anywhere, does it?
Shepherd's case is multiplied thousands of times across Britain, though not always with the same philosophical effect on the borrower. Shepherd and her boyfriend simply can't find a mortgage company that will give them a low fixed rate, so they'll have to resort to the higher floating mortgage rate and scrimp and save to try to meet the payments. If not, they'll have to sell. Mortgage lenders have been flooded with applications from people like Jessica Shepherd trying to renegotiate their mortgage rate, to the point that several, such as the Bath Building Society, have withdrawn almost their entire range of mortgage products. Dick Jenkins is its chief executive.
We've been getting inquiries in recent weeks and days at several times our normal level, and there's only so far you can take that before service starts to be impacted. Now, we don't want to get to that level, so we've actually decided to withdraw our product range before we get to that point.
It's a challenge not just in Britain, but right across Europe, especially in countries like Spain and Ireland, where there's been a huge housing boom that's now turning to bust.
I think it would be surprising if we didn't see some European banks get into fairly serious trouble.
Alan Ahern of the National University of Ireland was formerly a senior economist at the US Federal Reserve. He says the housing problems across the continent have come at the same time as a number of other economic problems, such as the rise in value of the euro that has affected exports. In some European countries, such as France and Germany, there have been plenty of problems. German banks have bought mortgage-backed securities from US lenders, for instance. But generally, Ahern says, in these countries, where there hasn't been such a housing boom and where there's more regulation and less reckless lending, the fallout has been less severe.
There are certainly structural problems in the European economy. These are well known, with labour market inflexibility and some other problems where product market deregulation is needed. But the fact that they hadn't gone through the property booms and busts, I think, does mean that they should be in a slightly stronger position.
The sheer volatility of the situation in Britain was shown dramatically on last Wednesday. Rumours began to fly on London trading floors that Britain's biggest mortgage lender, HBOS, was seeking billions of dollars of support from the Bank of England, just as the doomed Northern Rock Bank did last year. Shares nosedived before HBOS and the Bank of England firmly denied the rumours. The government financial watchdog, the Financial Services Authority, is now investigating whether rogue traders falsely planted the rumours to take advantage of the jittery financial climate here in order to make money. Rob Gifford, NPR News, London.
US officials say success in Afghanistan can be measured in the country's growing network of roads. More than 1,500 miles have been built, paved or repaved in the past 5 years. One of them is the Ring Road, a vast beltway linking the country's far-flung provinces. From the air, it looks like an American freeway, with trucks and cars whizzing along. But on the ground, Afghan drivers say the Ring Road and other highways like it are more like the Wild West. NPR's Soraya Sahadi Nelson reports from Kandahar.
Young drivers compete for passengers at the central taxi and bus station in the southern city of Kandahar. But there are few takers on this morning. A growing number of Afghans are afraid to travel by road. Taxi driver Abdul Wadi says that's because the roads are no longer safe. Not just from the Taliban and roadside bombs, but from police officers collecting illegal tolls and from bandits seeking hostages. Abdul Wadi says he'll only ferry passengers to Kabul from Kandahar during daylight hours, and only if he has a full car, because he feels there's safety in numbers. But he acknowledges the improving quality of the Afghan road network, and that's a view shared by many here. They say it is faster and easier to get around than ever before, especially in the south, east, and west, where newly paved roads abound. Take the trip from Kandahar to Kabul. Mohammed Ehsan, deputy chair of Kandahar's provincial council, says he could get there in less than 5 hours, about a quarter of the time it used to take him. But he never drives to Kabul anymore.
I don't dare to drive because the security is so bad. As a politician, I'm a target, so I only fly.
Trucking company manager Abdul Qadir says he has no choice but to send his drivers out on the roads, that despite the sometimes weekly hijackings of his convoys. On this morning, the somber-looking manager in a flashy beige and silver turban is trying to secure the release of two of his drivers and three trucks filled with construction supplies. They were hijacked a couple hours after leaving the western city of Herat. He says the kidnappers are demanding the equivalent of $36,000, money he says the owner will likely pay. It would cost more to replace the trucks. Abdul Qadir says he asked police at a checkpoint close to where the convoy was attacked to help. He claims the officers refused, telling him that getting the trucks and drivers back was his problem, which is why Abdul Qadir, like the drivers interviewed for the story, say they want Afghan and Western soldiers to maintain law and order on the nation's roads. U.S. General Dan McNeil says every truck driver may want a coalition escort, but it can't be done.
That's not my job. I'll do my best, and I have escorted some convoys, but I don't have the force to spend every day on that ring road. If somebody thinks that's the answer, then give us more force.
What U.S. and NATO forces have been doing is stepping up efforts to revamp the Afghan police. They've started intensive training to improve their policing skills and teach them ethics. In Kandahar, Governor Asadullah Khalid has taken more drastic measures to stop the shakedowns. Last month, he fired some 200 police officers in a volatile district at the eastern edge of his province after complaints from drivers about the unauthorized tax police were forcing them to pay. But the illegal tolls continue to be collected in many other areas. Here, in front of the customs house at the edge of Kandahar, truck driver Zargol says he and his colleagues count on paying $120 to crooked cops each time they make a run between Kandahar and Kabul. That's twice as much as Zargol says he earns per run. But to their employers, it's simply the cost of doing business, a cost they pass on to their clients. Another practice the truckers have adopted is to drive with one of their back doors open. They say it allows Taliban fighters hiding in the hillsides to see that drivers are not carrying goods for the Western coalition or government. Otherwise, they run the risk of being shot with rocket-propelled grenades or blown up with remote-controlled bombs. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Kandahar.
The Ministry of Defense in Bulgaria is preparing to auction off some pieces of European military history, which have been lying forgotten and half-buried in the ground there for decades. Collectors of vintage military vehicles are already lining up to bid on about 40 Nazi German tanks, which were once used to protect Bulgaria's southern border during the Cold War. NPR's Ivan Watson reports.
Sunset in the rolling farmland of Bulgaria's southern border with Turkey. 60-year-old Pyotr Dmitrov is on horseback, herding a flock of sheep past a hilltop where a half-dozen rusting tank cannons poke out from between the weeds. The tanks have been there since I was a child. They're from the Germans, Dmitrov says. The government used to make us practice shooting the guns in case the Turks invaded us. In the dark days of the Cold War, communist Bulgaria fortified this border with NATO's Turkey by embedding scores of Soviet and Nazi tanks in a network of concrete bunkers. The bunkers have been abandoned for years.
I'm walking now down concrete steps that are littered with twigs and old leaves into what was a bunker here. It's pitch black as I step in here, and there's a shaft of light coming down, and I can see up, I'm looking up into it now, into the turret of a tank gun that was half buried in the ground here, with the cannon facing towards Turkey.
In 2004, Bulgaria joined the NATO alliance. The old German panzers were left rusting and all but forgotten. That is, until this month, when the Bulgarian government suddenly announced it was unearthing the vehicles and selling them in an auction. Blagoy Miljanov is the deputy director of Bulgaria's National Museum of Military History.
We see much more interest in the tanks today, after one of the most valuable vehicles was stolen. This tank had an inscription, proving it was a gift from Adolf Hitler to the Queen of Bulgaria.
Miljanov says Hitler's tank mysteriously disappeared sometime last fall. In December, Bulgarian authorities arrested two German citizens and a Bulgarian army officer and accused them of stealing the tank and somehow smuggling it out of the country.
No, they have no proof, nothing. It's just talking bullshit.
Thomas Gemeiner is one of the German defendants in the case. He runs a private tank museum in Germany, which has a collection of more than 60, mostly World War II-era tanks. Gemeiner denies stealing the tank and fought the charges against him in a Bulgarian court. But then he fled the country last month. He spoke by telephone from Germany.
So are you a wanted man here in Bulgaria now?
Now at the moment in Bulgaria, yes.
You are wanted for stealing tanks right now?
Yes. It's very funny.
This week, the Bulgarian government was supposed to hold an auction for some of the remaining Nazi tanks. But at the last minute, the auction was postponed. Blagoy Miljanov of the Military Museum says the Bulgarians realized the starting prices of the vehicles were far too low.
Collectors are prepared to pay inappropriately large amounts of money for these valuable pieces of military heritage.
Miljanov calls the tanks a historical gold mine, but for some other Bulgarians, they were more of a playground. At this sheep farm near the border, 25-year-old Ivan Zhilyaskov says he grew up playing on the tanks near his childhood home.
For me, this is normal when I see the tank.
Zhilyaskov is a border guard now who's protecting the Bulgarian frontier from a very different threat. Economic migrants from the Middle East and Africa who are desperate to smuggle themselves illegally into Bulgaria and the much wealthier European Union.
Dangerous is the people from Iraq, from Iran. Won't come many people. This is the problem.
Illegal immigration is a 21st century challenge for Bulgaria that even modern-day tanks cannot solve. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Melnitsa, Bulgaria.
Coming up, entering a time warp in Nepal.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. From time to time, as he travels around his region, NPR's South Asia correspondent, Philip Reeves, sends us a letter about what he's just seen. Well, he's just returned from a visit to Kathmandu, the capital of Nepal, and here's his report.
Some nations seem determined to be eccentric. Nepal is a very small country, an oblong on the southern flank of the Himalayas, tucked between two giants, India and China. Yet it has its own unique time zone. Its clocks are ahead of India's by 15 minutes. Nepalese say this is a way of asserting their independence. And if you go north and step over the border into Chinese-controlled Tibet, you move forward in time by 2.25 hours. The Nepalese blame this on the Chinese, who set the hour to the time in Beijing, 2,000 miles away. For visitors to Nepal, this can all be very irksome, especially if you need regularly to tune into the hourly news from the US. You try working out a 9.75 hour time difference in a hurry. After a while, though, you realise Nepal's time warp is not about the hour, but the year. Richard Nixon and Mao Zedong were in power when Deep Purple's Smoke on the Water was released. More than 3.5 decades later, young Nepalis in this Kathmandu bar still enthusiastically rock away to it. Though the song came out before most of them were born, they know all the words. Here, the old hits never seem to die. It's the same all over town. Listen to what the students are playing on their laptops in this cafe. That long black cloud is coming down. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Step, if you will, into the car in which I'm being driven around the city and back to the days of the Vietnam War. There's a reason for this phenomenon. Kathmandu has never forgotten the 70s. In those days, the city lay at the end of a hippie trail. Crowds of hairy Western youths would travel here to find themselves, or was it lose themselves, in a haze of hashish smoke. Many came on the Magic Bus, a cheapo coach service from Europe. Its psychedelic vehicles rattled joyously along the old Silk Road, the same route used by Alexander the Great. It's easy to guess what the mullahs of Iran and Afghanistan made of these decorous youngsters in bandanas and bare feet. The more open-minded Nepalis simply found the hippies unusual. They gave them a name. Freaks. This was the hippies' favourite spot in the middle of Kathmandu. It's still called Freak Street. Even now, you occasionally see ancient and bedraggled former hippies wandering around revisiting old haunts. The shops still sell Jimi Hendrix and Cat Stevens and Ban the Bomb signs. But the place is not what it was. In this cafe, they're playing all the old songs. But there are signs on the tables warning customers not to smoke dope. The authorities cracked down on drugs long ago, and they say the police can be pretty ruthless. The cops know the time of day, even if no one else in Nepal does. Philip Reeves, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.